Welcome to At the Organ, a weekly show about the classical organ and its music, heard on organlive.com every Sunday or streaming from our website anytime. Just point your browser to attheorgan.com for more information. Now, let's hear what's happening this week at the organ.
Hello, and thank you for joining me today on At the Organ. My name is Brent Johnson, and it's good to be back here with you. Jim Logue is away today, but he'll be back next week. Today, I would like to take you to Independence, Missouri, to visit a great Aeolian Skinner organ and to talk with Dr. David Pickering. Today is Sunday, August 24th. Just this past week, I found myself in the Community of Christ Auditorium in Independence, Missouri, just outside of Kansas City. The history of the church in this part of Missouri dates back to the 1830s, when the area near Independence was selected to be the home for the church founded by Joseph Smith. It took until the early 20th century until work began on the auditorium, designed to house all the attendance of the church's world conferences, as well as to contain office space for the church headquarters. The massive auditorium seats nearly 6,000 people, and it was decided early on that only a pipe organ could fill such a space with music. In 1959, an Aeolian Skinner organ was installed in the auditorium. G. Donald Harrison, tonal director of the company, designed much of the instrument, but did not live to see it completed. The organ was heard all over the world in recordings and in a weekly radio show performed by auditorium organist Dr. John Obetz. Today, the organ continues to play and is heard in regular recitals overseen by auditorium organist Jan Krabill. Dr. David Pickering is the assistant professor of music and chair of the keyboard division at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. As a master's student at the University of Kansas, Dr. Pickering wrote a thesis on the history and installation of the auditorium organ. He has since expanded this thesis, and it has now been published as a complete book titled The Auditorium Organ. I sat down with Dr. Pickering in the auditorium, right in the shadow of the organ's giant 32-foot facade pipes, and asked him to tell us a little of the history of the building and how his interest in the organ started.
The Community of Christ Church, which was then known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, early in the 20th century, the church really desired a place that church members could gather to attend the church's, what was then known as General Conference at the time, which was a meeting that was held regularly where church members received instruction, where they received inspiration, and where also business of the church was conducted. And so they really desired a building such as this, and plans for the auditorium were then hatched at that particular time, mainly as a place for gathering. And this was not designed to be a regular church where worship service was held every particular week. I mean, just looking at the size and scope of it, you know, seats nearly 6,000 people. Plans were begun at that particular time. And, you know, as I'd mentioned before, you know, took a great deal of time and sacrifice on part of church members financially to finance the construction of such a building. Thankfully, the church leadership at the time, knowing that whenever church members gather, it's always nice to have music and to have hymns singing that's accompanied, and because of the organ's size and ability to produce a great deal of sound, knew that the pipe organ would be the right means to do that. I would say that this interest in this particular instrument started really when I was in graduate school at the University of Kansas, just about an hour away from here. I attended John Obetz's last performance here, formal performance here, in his role as auditorium organist. He gave a farewell recital, and the first portion of that took place here in the auditorium, and then the second half took place in the temple. And so I had just recently begun my master's degree at the University of Kansas at that time, and so I decided to, you know, come on over, hear the instruments. I had, you know, been well acquainted with John and his work here, and had heard the organ, I remember, once on a CD recording that John had made during my undergraduate years. And so had the chance to come here and to hear him play the instrument. And then a few years later, was finishing up my work at the University of Kansas, and as part of my degree study there, had pursued a master's in musicology degree, and as part of the requirements for that degree had to complete a thesis. And then the great question began of what the thesis was going to entail. And so after a lot of thought and a lot of dead-end roads of things that had already been researched, I was one day sitting up in a practice room and just really wondered what in heaven's name I was going to do for this musicology thesis. And the idea came to me to look and see if anything had been done on the Community of Christ Auditorium organ. And after some initial searching, I realized nothing had been done. And I had had the good fortune of meeting Jan Crable just a year or so before, year or two before. And so I contacted her and asked if this might be a possibility. And she was very accommodating. And so then my trips to Independence began. Really, very little had been written. There was the initial article in the Diapason, which just basically consisted of the stop list when the instrument had first been installed. Couple of short articles about the auditorium organ radio broadcast and about some work that Michael Quimby had done with the instrument in the 1980s, but really not very much. And so there was an interesting history to be discovered.
And that's an interesting idea. I don't know of many people that will do, I don't know what we call it, an organography, an organ biography, to actually explore the history of a single instrument as part of a research project.
Yeah, and I, you know, talked with my musicology advisor at the time, Walter Clark, who was then at the University of Kansas. And, you know, at first I was a little leery of the fact that they would say, well, no, you've got to do some, you know, official study of some ancient manuscript or who knows what else, you know, to qualify and that this just doesn't count or it's not musicologically valid enough. But he was very supportive and thought that it would be an excellent thing to do. And I think, because of the interesting history this instrument has had, one really could almost write a single book about this instrument only.
When did the project evolve into a full book?
One, I think, eventually, you know, when they finish graduate school, the idea, I think, usually is that projects like this can hopefully not just end at the thesis or the dissertation or whatever, but that it can serve as the step into a larger either book project or to, you know, a published article or something like that. And so I know I talked with Jan about the possibility of the church publishing the book or the thesis into book form. And unfortunately, that wasn't possible at the time. And so I then contacted Jonathan Ambrosino out of Massachusetts and asked him if he wouldn't mind reading a draft of the thesis. And, you know, with his experience with alien skin organs, had thought that might be a good place to start. So he was very kind enough, you know, I sent him, you know, a paper copy of the manuscript, and he was very kind to read through that, and then a few months later got it back, had some interesting ideas of maybe in ways in which the thesis could be expanded, probably because it was a little short as it was to really qualify as a book. And so he had some good ideas there. And then not only did that involve some revision, but then involved some extra writing on some other facets of the instrument and the history. And then the task really became to find a publisher. And I'd really pretty much given up hope of finding a publisher because just of what I had been considering at the time and what I thought was available. And thankfully, I contacted some of the Oregon Historical Society for some information about the instrument, I believe, or some facet of the project. And they happened to say, well, have you considered the Oregon Historical Society Press? And of course, I felt really stupid because I'd completely forgotten about the Oregon Historical Society Press. And so I sent them a manuscript, and they expressed a definite interest in wanting to publish the book. Jonathan actually had the very interesting idea of including a chapter about a large organ in a large space in a denomination that wasn't necessarily one of the large mainstream denominations at the time. I mean, you know, you have the Community of Christ Church that has, you know, the auditorium, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when it first, you know, built the tabernacle and the tabernacle organ. Other, even things such as the Crystal Cathedral in California, which was the branch of the Dutch Reformed Church, you know, doing somewhat of a similar thing. It was actually a very interesting study to investigate these instruments, or Ocean Grove Auditorium, and some other instruments of that nature. And so I actually wrote a chapter on that. And then the OHS Press decided that maybe that wasn't necessary for the book's inclusion as itself, you know, in itself. But the thing that probably contributed most to the current manuscript of this particular book was some interesting documentation that existed in the Community of Christ archives that somehow I did not run across the first time I did the thesis, and that was that the search for the organ here didn't really begin in the 1940s like most people had thought, but that there was a completely separate attempt in the later 1920s to early 1930s when this auditorium was under construction to build an instrument at that time. And some fascinating correspondence from church authorities at the time, as well as with the Vodi division of the Aeolian division, or the Aeolian company, and then also with Ernest Skinner to build an instrument at that particular time. Also correspondence from Kimball, Pilcher, a few other builders. And so that really was an interesting way in which that thesis could be expanded and added a whole other dimension to the book that the thesis didn't have.
So it gives you a complete history of the whole process, even the attempts that didn't succeed.
That's exactly right. And fascinating for most people, because I think for almost everybody, this was information they had no idea had ever happened.
And so you had access to all of that through the archives of the church?
I did, and they were very generous in sharing the information with me, and it was just fascinating. And a lot of the correspondence was so interesting, I just couldn't refrain from doing some fairly extensive quoting, because it really added, I think, a whole depth of persona and interest in the book.
And it was interesting to see some of those early specs and imagine what those instruments might have been like.
Oh, it was.
Between 1930 and 1959.
The Aeolian organ was particularly interesting. I mean, it was a huge instrument, close to 200 ranks. And, of course, at that time, the auditorium was even slated to be larger than it is now. And so no specifics of that still exist as far as exactly how large the auditorium was supposed to be. But when you look at the possibility of a near 200 rank instrument built, you know, sort of in the what you might call early American symphonic style, I mean, it wasn't really what we would call, you know, the orchestral instrument with, you know, 58 foot stops and 24s and no mixture. I mean, it really, you know, had some interesting aspects to the stop list, had a really full choruses, but looked just absolutely heroic in specification. So to see something like that and to imagine what this would have been like had that instrument been built was truly stunning.
Instruments are not only a result of the time and necessity of when they're designed and built, but the personalities that are involved in the whole process. Your book covers all of the people that were involved.
That's exactly right. The person who was first involved way back in the 1920s was a man by the name of Arthur Mills, and he had had some organ training, was involved with the music department here at the Community of Christ Church at the time. The person who really emerged as the driving force behind the bringing of the Aeolian Skinner organ here to the auditorium was a church member by the name of Bethel Kanochi, who had been raised in the southeastern part of Kansas, was a church member, Eventually had settled here, was involved with the radio broadcast at the church's Stone Church congregation across the street from here, and had really emerged as sort of the primary organist of the church, and was basically the church's staff organist. The auditorium itself had begun many years beforehand, and due to the Great Depression and the monies involved with the construction of the building, the church had had to suspend operations for most of the Great Depression. And so even though some of the church's early conferences in the 1920s were held in the building wasn't completed. And the church president at the time had really envisioned that an organ, a pipe organ, would be housed here. And Bethel, with her acquaintanceship with church leaders here, was pretty much engaged as the primary contact. And so when things began to emerge from the Great Depression and the Second World War, the church really looked to her as the inspiration for where this new instrument would come from. And Bethel, having had received some organ training but realizing that she needed some outside expertise and assistance, looked to one of the famous organists in organ, really by that time organ teachers at the time, Harold Gleason. And I think she'd been mostly acquainted with him through his organ method that had really taken off at the time and was used as a primary instruction manual for organists at the time. And so she contacted him at the Eastman School of Music and asked initially if she could pursue graduate studies with him since she had a bachelor's degree. And he initially told her, he says, well, I'm just full, you know, I have no room left in my studio, and, you know, thanks for your inquiry. And she was just absolutely desperate that she get this man's attention, and so she had thought, well, maybe this will get his attention. And she described the possibility for an organ project here at the auditorium, and that was enough to whet his appetite. And he says, fine. He says, I will take you on as a student. And so she went back every summer for, I believe, about 7 years to undertake studies with him at the master's degree level. Gleason and his wife, Catherine Crozier, then became the consultants for this organ and were very involved with Bethel in helping guide her as to how this organ search might proceed. And the interesting thing was is that Harold Gleason really wanted to find out about the church, about how the role music played in the church, and really helped guide her for things that she might be interested in looking for, but didn't really insist that she go with a particular builder, but really gave her the tools wherewith she would be able to find this information and was there to, you know, be a consultant. But really, Bethel almost came to the realization on her own that Aeolian Skinner should be the builder that built this instrument.
You're listening to At the Organ.
Today we're in the Community of Christ Auditorium in Independence, Missouri, talking with Dr. David Pickering, whose book, The Auditorium Organ, details the story of this organ. For the listener that has never experienced the instrument, I asked Dr. Pickering to describe it to us.
Well, the instrument, I think, in this space truly is, it's heroic in many ways. It's the largest organ in the Kansas City metropolitan area. In addition to providing, you know, some very heroic and powerful sounds, it really is capable of a wide dynamic. It's can be very soft, and pretty much any kind of sound in between that you desire, this instrument has. It's large enough. Of particular note to many people are the set of horizontal trumpets that are at the rear of the auditorium. These were inspired by the state trumpet that was found at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. Interestingly, Harold Gleason was able to refer instruments that Bethel should see and play, and St. John the Divine was one of those. She went out to New York, New England, and to play what at that time were many of Aeolian Skinner's newer instruments, and came across the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. She records that Alec Whiten, who was the organist there at the time, pulled the state trumpet on and then asked her to play a C major chord. And she wrote that at first nothing happened, of course, because of the time delay, and then said, "That sound just hit me and I just had to hang on, and then I knew I had to have that trumpet in this organ." And she was very particular about that. And actually, it wasn't included in the specification of this organ originally. Interestingly enough, her decision to go with Aeolian Skinner came when she came into contact with a Skinner organ in St. Louis. And since Skinner was no longer building instruments under his own name at the time, Aeolian Skinner was the builder that they chose. The organ, I think, is particularly successful in this space. The room acoustic is quite resonant. And so really there's a feeling, I think, of majesty and of just having this be in such a large, inviting, warm space.
There's a lot of time between, of course, the construction of the building and even in the process of finding this organ when the process started again. Were there any special challenges of getting this instrument to work in the room or to fit in the room? Or
there were a few. G. Donald Harrison, who was the tonal director of Aeolian Skinner, made some initial visits here in the mid-1950s and drew up the specifications for the instrument initially. And then in 1956, he suddenly died of a heart attack. And so this instrument, you know, was still in the planning stages at that time. The church authorities and Bethel felt very strongly to continue with what G. Donald Harrison had proposed. And Joseph Whiteford, who then became president at the time, carried those through in pretty much a general way. Probably one of the single greatest hurdles for the instrument was the installation of the 32-foot principal pipes that you see. Those ended up being slightly too tall to be winded in the traditional fashion, and so they had, Aeolian Skinner had the idea to then wind some of the lowest pipes through vacuum hose that they acquired from Sears. And you can look in the back of the pipes this day, and that is where they were. They initially, I mean, before they had come up with the vacuum hose idea, they'd thought, oh my goodness, well, we just may not be able to include those pipes. And Harold Gleason was very much against the use of a resultant at the time. Harold had suggested possibly that maybe, you know, the low C sharp would basically sound for the lowest, you know, two or three notes, and that, you know, most people wouldn't be able to tell the difference, but thankfully they were able to overcome that hurdle with the installation of those particular pipes. As I think about the difficulties that they had at the time, that was probably the most difficult relating to the organ's installation itself. Once the organ was installed, there were some initial settling issues, controlling room humidity level to, you know, not cause other problems that, you know, heat can cause when the air is really dry. But initially, I think that was the primary hurdle that they faced. One notices the organ's designed that a great deal of the organ's pipework is out in the open, and really the space that was budgeted for the organ is pretty much the space where the swell and choir divisions are currently housed. Everything else then, from the grate and positive and the pedal and the bombard divisions, had to actually be brought out in front of that area, and really to accommodate an instrument that was loud enough and big enough to work in a space like this.
Your book also details any changes that have been made, which is always, sometimes people like to sweep little things like that under the rug and say that the organ has always been made perfect, but of course some changes have happened over the years. All of that is archived, or you are able to find out from actually talking to the people who performed the work?
Probably the greatest, quite a bit of that was archived. Thankfully, when I came here, John Obetz, who had been in the position as auditorium organist from 1967 to 1998, had kept a great deal of material. And so Jan, when she initially showed me the room where all of these were housed, thankfully I was given no copy budget, and basically I just copied. This was before we had digital cameras that would just take all of this, and I just went to town with a copy machine and walked out with armloads of paperwork. A lot of the initial work with this organ was documented. John had saved quite a bit of that. I think the initial questions with the organ initially were, was the instrument really loud enough for the space? And, you know, most organists are, as we know, very opinionated in what they feel is right or not. And there was some divergence of opinion on that. And so some attempts initially were made to have the instrument be a little louder. And so a lot of that documentation was done. And then in the mid-1980s, Michael Quimby and his company were contracted to renovate the instrument and to address maybe some further issues of balance and of the instrument's presence in the room. He was very helpful in sharing exactly what that company had done. And really, it was able then to provide, I was able to provide a documented stop list of what had been done to each rank of the organ. And thankfully, I had that inspiration from Barbara Owen's book on the Salt Lake Tabernacle organ, because she included a similar annotated stop list at the end of that particular book to show some changes that had been made to that Aeolian Skinner as well.
The book is The Auditorium Organ. It's published by the OHS Press. Links to purchase the book can be found on our website at theorgan.com. There you'll also find links to Dr. Pickering's profile, a specification of the auditorium organ, and to the Community of Christ's Dome and Spire Fine Art Series. If you find yourself near Independence, the auditorium and the nearby temple with its Cassavant organ are both open for tours and regular recitals. Just visit their website for more information. My thanks today go to David Pickering, as well as David Bolton and Jeff Benson at the Community of Christ Auditorium, and Renee Zonier for all their help in bringing today's show to you. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you'll join us again next week when Jim Logue will be back. Remember, if you have any comments for me or our production team, you can email us at info@theorgan.com. And if you want to join in the discussion about this show, visit our website, attheorgan.com, where you can leave comments for us and for other listeners. You can also find links to our Facebook page and our Twitter feed, both of which we update with bits of organ music history throughout the week. I'm Brent Johnson, and hope to see you here again soon at The Organ.
You've been listening to At The Organ, a weekly look at the art and music of the classical organ. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. Send your email to info@theorgan.com, or just go to our website where you can comment on the show. There you can also hear this week's show again or find back episodes. The address is attheorgan.com. At The Organ is a production of the Organ Media Foundation. For more information about supporting the foundation or sponsoring an episode of At the Organ, go to organmedia.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll meet you here next week at the Organ.